This audio is brought to you by MuslimCentral.com.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم إن الحمد لله وبه نستعين والصلاة والسلام على سيد المرسلين وعلى آله وصحبه أجمعين. Is this loud enough? I can talk louder. Is that better? So I did write the outline of this talk on a Starbucks napkin, but that doesn't mean that I don't take it seriously. It just means that when whatever, you know, inspiration struck me that struck me, it happened to be that I was in a Starbucks and I didn't have any paper. So it's no reflection on the audience or my esteem for them. In fact, I'm quite taken by the minbar here, which is beautiful. And someone after this will have to explain to me, you know, the history of this mosque and who came up with this design. I think the topic that has come up actually several times since I've been here in Southern California, and several people have asked me about it, and I haven't really addressed it in any talks yet. And so as I've given numerous speeches so far in the week I've been here, I've kind of been running out of things to say, because people keep coming to the same talks. At least one or two people are there, so can't well give them the same speech. So I think not only is this something that I haven't talked about yet in my visit to this area, but also I think it's extremely important, and it's on many people's minds. It's related to the talk listed on the title of the event, but it's not exactly the same. It has to do with the relationship between the Quran the Quran and the Sunnah of the Prophet alayhi salatu wasalam. And of course, one of the ways that we know about the Sunnah of the Prophet is our hadiths about the Prophet, about his words and his deeds. This often this comes up in people's lives, Muslims' lives in America. Sometimes it's a debate between family members or between friends, and oftentimes it's discussed in the context of what sometimes called the Quran-only movement or the Ahle Quran, which is a movement that really arose in what was then British India in the late 1800s and the early part of the 20th century, and later had a flare-up in Egypt in the early 20th century. And today is something you find not only in Pakistan especially, but also in some forms in Turkey and amongst some Muslims in the West. So I wanted to talk about this movement and to talk about the relationship between the Quran and the Sunnah, and to try my best to give credit to people's intentions on these affairs, but also to, I think, try and give at least what I think is a good understanding of the proper relationship, the necessary relationship between the Quran and the Sunnah, the necessary role of the Sunnah in the lives of Muslims. There, I think that if you look behind the complaints or the concerns or the motivations of those people who believe that the Quran should really, the Islam and the practices and belief of Muslims should only be taken from the Quran, I think that it's important to see what is it that is kind of digging into their heart. Part of it is a disappointment with the way that Islam has been explained to them, the way that, let's say, more traditional ulama have presented Islam. Sometimes they think that this Islam is not really suitable for the modern world, that it doesn't represent the true values that they understand is coming from the Quran and from the Prophet, and therefore that it has to in some way be a misunderstanding, it has to in some way be a mischaracterization of the true teachings of the Quran and of the Prophet. I think there's also an element of class, right? A lot of times, if you look in South Asia, people who become ulama are, you know, from poorer families, from families that weren't very close to the British, just to the British Raj or to the elite that remained after the end of the empire. And the oftentimes Ahle Quran people, the original formulators of this theology or this ideology in this movement were people who were working with the British, who were working in the elite. And so in a way, the Quran only movement becomes a way to create a vision of Islam that is free of the ulama and their kind of lower class traditionalism, but also is still Muslim and compatible with the values of the kind of westernized culture to which they're aspiring. So I think these are important, at least for me, I feel they're accurate characterizations. And I think that they're characterizations that apply to Muslims in the West, especially in the United States, not necessarily in Europe, but certainly in the United States, where Muslims from immigrant backgrounds tend to be upper middle class, even upper class professionals who are very accomplished, who are very educated, who value education, and often see imams back in their home countries as coming from, as representing to be frank, what they see as a backward approach to religion, a backward approach to life in general. So the traditional Islamic sciences become associated with backwardness, and so breaking free of them and saying, you know, we want to break free of all these ulama and their hadith that they tell us and the way that they're telling us we have to understand the Quran. We want to understand the Quran as modern people, as people who are educated, as people who are influenced by the West. I think that we have to see this motivation and not, I personally don't agree with this motivation. I don't think it's correct. But, you know, I often feel it myself. You can, and I think maybe many, especially educated Muslims in the West have felt these sentiments before. So they're not invalid sentiments. I think Joseph, Dr. Lombard really should be giving this part of the talk, but if I say something wrong, just raise your hand or throw like an empty water bottle at me and I'll try and adjust, or throw a message with a piece of paper, a paper airplane. I'll try and adjust if I make any mistakes. But I think we need to think about the ways in which the Quran speaks to us. How has the Quran spoken to Muslims over the centuries? During the life of the Prophet, the Quran speaks to Muslims, to his followers, and to him directly, in context that they understand. Just as if I'm speaking to you today about events that are happening in the news or about challenges this community is facing immediately, we would understand exactly what I'm speaking about. If you go, however, a decade or a century or even a year or 1,400 years into the future, to understand what the Quran is saying becomes a great challenge. And we see that the Quran can speak to us on many different levels. The Quran can speak in universals. The Quran can make universal declarations about the nature of God. God's oneness does not change when automobiles are invented. Oneness does not change when you're at peace versus at war. God's mercy, God's creative power, God's justice, these things don't change. So discussions of the natures of God are by definition eternal truths. They're universal truths. The Quran gives us universal moral truths. إِنَّ اللَّهَ يَأْمُرُ بِالْعَدْلِ وَالْإِحْسَانِ وَإِتَاءِ ذِي الْقُرْبَى وَيَنْهَى عَنِ الْفَحْشَاءِ وَالْمُنكَرِ وَالْبَغْيِ يَعِظُكُمْ لَعَلَّكُمْ تَذَكَّرُونَ. God commands you to justice, to goodness and perfection, to taking care of those who are close relatives of yours, those related to you. He forbids from you things that are unacceptable and wrong, things that are excessive or reaching. He tells you this, he warns you of this, he preaches to you of this that you may heed. These are universal, this is an eternal command that will always be applicable to human beings. Its application in an immediate situation might change. What does justice mean? What does goodness mean today in the United States? What does justice mean? What does goodness mean when a homeless person asks me for money? Do I give it to him or her or not? Maybe I will be hurting them if I do this. Maybe I should give them something else. Maybe I should help them in other ways. What is justice is disagreed upon by people in particular situations, and that's totally normal. But the call to justice, the command to justice, when God says, ادعوا لسبيل ربكم بالحكمة والموعظة الحسنة, call to the path of your Lord with wisdom and goodly preaching. This is a a universal command. It will always apply. The Quran warns us away from sins that are universal for Muslims. They will always be sinful. La taqrabu zina. Do not approach zina. You know, that alcohol, that wine has good benefits and harms, but that the harms outweigh the benefits, and that ultimately it is a rijis, it is a foul thing, a tool from the one of the tools of the devil that we should avoid. These are always going to be true. It doesn't matter if you're in a place like, let's say, Utah, where no one drinks, or if you're in a place like Boston, where everybody drinks. I'm just joking. But there are a lot of people from a certain island that we have affection for, where there's a lot of alcohol drinking. So that's never going to change. The Quran speaks to us through particulars in the life of the Prophet, but that particulars that even though they might refer to him, alayhi salatu wasalam, also resonate with us. And I remember the moment in my life, I was already Muslim, but had been Muslim maybe for about a year or so, but the moment in my life that has always been a touchstone for truth and certainty, and that no matter how confused I get, no matter how lazy I get, no matter how distant I feel from God, I always go back to this moment. Is the truest moment in my life. And when I was traveling in the summer with one of my friends, we were traveling in Senegal and Mali, and we were in we were in Bamako, the capital of Mali. We were taking a bus to, and sometimes Yusuf is here, was at University of Chicago with me, and probably maybe I told this story in a khutbah there. I apologize for the repeat information, but this is a good example, at least for me. We were traveling from Bamako to the city of Mopti, and it was about a 12-hour or 8-hour bus ride. And it was the summertime in Mali. It was very hot. And we both felt great, but I started feeling a little bit of a tickle in my throat. And within half an hour, I was the sickest I'd ever been in my whole life. I felt like my throat hurt so much, I felt like it was bleeding on the inside. And of course, we know in the news today that in Africa there's some pretty serious diseases. And I was, I had no idea what was afflicting me. I was terrified, I was miserable. We were on this bus, and it was so crowded and so hot. And I was in complete agony. My whole body ached. I've never been so miserable. And the Malian guy next to me had this boombox, this stereo on batteries, and he was playing the Police sound, the Roxanne and Don't Stand So Close to Me and Walking on the Moon. To this day, I cannot listen to any of those songs over and over and over again at full volume. I felt like I was going insane. And it was a moment in which I had the most profound doubt I've ever had in my life. I remember, we could have a whole other lecture given by someone worthier than me about what kufr means. But kufr is not atheism. Kufr is not saying God doesn't exist. Kufr is ingratitude to God. Kufr is covering up the truth. It's ingratitude at its heart. And it's funny that in this most profound moment of doubt I've ever had in my life, I remember very clearly, I said, this is BS. God has never done anything for me. That was the most honest doubt I had in my life. And it was interesting. I didn't say God doesn't exist. I said, God has never done anything for me. And then in that moment, I'm not saying I had a revelation, which would be awkward to say in a mosque. But I when sometimes you're just a song lyric or something comes into your mind. Words came into mind. أَلَمْ يَجِدْكَ يَتِيمًا فَأَوَى وَوَجَدْكَ ضَالًا فَهَدَى وَوَجَدْكَ عَائِلًا فَأَغْنَى. Did God not find you astray, an orphan, and give you shelter, astray and guide you, poor and enrich you? And then I felt this overwhelming guidance, overwhelming comfort and truth, and I felt closer to the divine than I had ever felt in my life, the most perfect moment of happiness and content. And even though I was sick as a dog for the next couple of days, I was never happier, never more energetic in my life. And I've often thought about this because those verses are talking to the Prophet, alayhi salatu wasalam. God is comforting the Prophet after a period, thank you, jazakallah khair, early in his early in his prophethood, when he hasn't received revelations for a time, and he feels abandoned by God. Mawadaka Rabbuka wama qala. God has not abandoned you, nor does he disdain you, the Quran says. It's coming to comfort the prophet. And yet, here I am 1400 years later, and the verse is speaking to me in what I can only say is the most honest moment of my life. So that was even sometimes things that talk about the prophets can speak and comfort those in later days. There are other things in the Quran that speak to us as examples, that speak to us as parables, like the parable in Surah number 17 about the two men who have their two gardens. And one of them's garden is very rich and plentiful, and the other man's garden isn't. And the man whose rich garden is rich and plentiful said, "That's a bida hadhihi abada. This will never disappear. And even if I'm brought back to my Lord, surely he'll be merciful with me. Surely I'll find something better than this garden with my Lord." This confidence, this arrogance. And his friend, the believer, whose garden is smaller, says, "Why don't you say, Masha'Allah? La hawla wa la quwwata illa billah." Why don't you say, "This is what God is will. There is no power and force except God. Maybe God will give me a bigger garden than you. Maybe God will destroy your garden." And surely that, indeed, that's what happens to this man. So we have an example. We have a parable about how we should view earthly success, earthly wealth. How we should always, always understand that our life, our status in this dunya is fleeting. It's entirely dependent on God. That we never earn anything, that we are never sure of anything. And by the way, in that understanding, we can appreciate and more deeply what we have. So, or surahs like Tabbat Yada Abi Lahabin, Watab. The hands of Abu Lahab had perished, and he has perished. This surah can never speak about anybody else but Abu Lahab. It says this is Abu Lahab. So, I haven't met anyone named Abu Lahab in my life, but let's say I meet some guy named Abu Lahab. It, in theory, could possibly apply to him, but it can't, because it's speaking about a specific person who's condemned to hellfire, as was his wife. So some verses, or some even surahs here, they're locked into history. We can look at Abu Lahab as an example. We can know what his conduct was, why he failed the test of faith and righteousness, but it can never speak to another person as a prediction or as a rule. And then there are commands to the Prophet that are commands to him in particular situations, but that we can also understand as commandments. And these verses are the, in some ways, the trickiest for Muslim scholars, because they're constantly trying to understand as the years pass and situations change, how much is this command locked into the context in which it was revealed? How much is it a universal? And if we find ourselves in situations that are analogous to those in which the Prophet found himself when these verses were revealed, do those commands then apply to us, or do they not? This is a constant challenge that Muslims have until today. So when the Quran says, فَذَيَنْسَلَخَ شَهْرَ الْأَشْهُرَ الْحُرَمِ الْأَشْهُرَ الْحُرَمُ فَقْتُلَ الْمُشْرِكِينَ حَيْثُ وَجَدْتَمُوهُمْ. When in the beginning, the first 29 verses of Surah At-Tawbah, Surah number 9, when the Quran says, when the four sacred months have ended, then fight the polytheists wherever you find them. Is this, as some Muslim scholars have held, a command for Muslims to fight unbelievers or polytheists whenever they want? Or is it a command that has to be understood in the light of the first 29 verses of Surah At-Tawbah, in which it's talking about the Prophet's immediate conduct in a war that he's fighting with other groups, and that those groups with whom he has treaties, even if they're mushrikeen, that he has to abide by those treaties. But that those groups who are still his enemies, he gives them 4 months of respite and then fights them. So this is the challenge Muslim scholars have had. So what about some of the ways in which the Quran speaks to us, can speak to us, some of the ways in which the Quran challenges us to mine it for guidance. But how are we guided in our reading of the Quran? The Quran is a book that is bound up in the life of the Prophet, alayhi salatu wasalam. It is, in fact, impossible to read without his life and his sunnah, his precedent, before our eyes. And this is something that Muslim scholars understood very early on in Islam, and they were, I'm often stunned by their acuity and their intelligence, their wisdom. When early Muslim scholars like Ayyub al-Sakhthiani said, "Al-Kitab ahwaju ila sunnah min as-sunnah il-kitab." The Book of God needs the sunnah more than the sunnah needs the Book of God. Or as Yahya bin Abi Kathir and Az-Zuhri, early Muslim scholars, also said, that the sunnah came to govern the Quran. The Quran didn't come to govern the sunnah. What do they mean by that? They mean that you have to understand the Quran through the sunnah. The Quran tells you to pray. It doesn't tell you how to pray. It doesn't tell you when to pray. It doesn't tell you how many times to pray. The Prophet's teachings tell us how to pray, when to pray. The Quran tells you that blood and carrion, dead animals, are prohibited for you. The Quran, the Sunnah of the Prophet tells us that this doesn't apply to things that we find in the ocean. That even dead whales washed up on the seashore can be eaten from, like the companions of the Prophet did, and an act of which he approved. So the Sunnah is, it explains the Quran, it adds to the Quran, it affirms the Quran. It is, as one of my teachers in Azhar said, it is tatbiqun ma'sumun likitabillah. It is an infallible application of the Book of God. The Sunnah is the infallible application of the Book of God. And Bara, the lawyer, and maybe some other lawyers here who can tell you, this is an understanding that Muslims had that's shared, that it applies to really any time somebody gives you directions or writes a law for you. The law has to be explained. It has to be understood. When, for example, James Madison, the prime writer of the Constitution, the Constitution of the United States, said, these laws, they cannot be applied. They don't really come into existence until they are debated, until they are discussed, until they actually have to be applied. Laws as on the books, laws as an idea, laws as mere statements, words on paper, they don't mean anything until people actually try and apply them. Then they need guidance. Then they need to have these laws explained to them. That's precisely what the Sunnah of the Prophet does, alayhi salatu wasalam. Now this leaves us with the challenge or the crisis of Muslims and the Sunnah in the modern world. We need the Sunnah of the Prophet to understand the Quran. But which Sunnah of the Prophet? How do we understand that Sunnah? I'm sure you've heard this example before. I know my students did because I used it. But let's say Bara'a, which book did you read to teach you how to pray? Did you read a hadith to teach you how to pray? No, your parents probably taught you how to pray. So I'm probably the only person here who actually learned how to pray from a book because my parents weren't Muslim. Most people here learn to pray from their parents. And their parents learn to pray from their parents and from their parents. So when I say you need the Sunnah of the Prophet to know how to pray, you could say, I don't need the Sunnah of the Prophet. My parents taught me. But that tradition, that unbroken tradition, that living tradition, is a manifestation of the Sunnah of the Prophet. It's a manifestation of the Sunnah of the Prophet. And there are other things that are less crucial to the lives of Muslims that were also carried through tradition. For example, in Sharia law, in Sharia, if somebody murders somebody else, let's say, somebody murders their brother, their actual brother, normally they would inherit money from their brother. They would inherit from their brother's estate as automatically from the in the Quran. Or actually, that's not a good example. Let's say they murder their father. They would automatically inherit. But all Muslim scholars agree throughout history, if you murder somebody, you do not inherit from them. Al-qatil la yarith. The murderer does not inherit. There's no reliable hadith that says this. There's lots of hadiths that you find, but none of them are really sahih or even hasan. They're very unreliable hadiths. It just happened that no one transmitted this. But all the ulama understood this. From the beginning of Islam until today, no one ever questioned this rule. That's another aspect of the sunnah of the Prophet that was lived, handed down generation by after generation by Muslim scholars, by Muslims overall. But of course, once you get two families together, let's say they go and they're sitting there to have a barbecue, and one guy comes and says, "This is how I barbecue meat." And the other guy says, "That's not how you barbecue meat. This is how you barbecue meat." People, once they separate or once they spread out throughout the world, they start disagreeing. Tradition deviates. Customs are influenced by new lands and new peoples, new languages, new foods and clothing. So the living tradition of the Muslim community might be good enough to do things like preserve how we pray. But it always has to be kept in check by a more direct link back to the sunnah of the Prophet ﷺ. And that certainly is the case with the details of our law. With the details of our law. What about the specific rules of buying and selling things? What happens if two people, someone buying something and someone selling something, dispute about the price? What happens if they dispute about a contract they had? If we're told by the Quran that if we disagree on things, we should bring these things before God and the Prophet, before God and the Sunnah of the Prophet, before the Book of God and the teaching of His Prophet, then we need to seek out wisdom. We need to seek out answers in these sources. And we won't find them in living tradition. We find them in the hadiths, which are reports directly transmitted from the early period of Islam and recorded by the early generations of Muslims. People like Al-Bukhari, people like Imam Muslim, Malik ibn Anas, Ahmed ibn Hanbal, and others. Or for our South Asian brethren, At-Tahawi, our Hanafi friends. Of course, the great problem here is that Muslims understood that many hadiths were not reliable. Many hadiths were made up. If you had a political agenda or a religious agenda, or you just liked to wear certain types of clothing, or you didn't like some kinds of food, or you hated people from a certain city, or you wanted to have your contracts signed in a certain way, what better way to get this than by forging a hadith, by putting words in the mouth of the Prophet ﷺ? The methods of hadith criticism that Muslims invented, and that you see applied in books like the Sahih al-Bukhari and Sahih Muslim, they were invented because these scholars knew how many hadiths were forged. As one scholar named Shu'bah ibn al-Hajjaj, he was from the city of Basra, he died around 161 of the Hijri, about 773 or 774 of the Common Era. He said, 3/4 of the hadiths I have come across are forged. 3/4 of the hadiths I have come across are forged hadiths. Now he's two generations before, or even three generations before Bukhari and Muslim. So, Muslims in the modern period have a question before them. Which sunnah of the Prophet do they take? Which sunnah of the Prophet do they take? One, the answer that is provided by what becomes the Quran-only movement is an attempt to escape this problem by saying that we don't need the sunnah of the Prophet at all. That debate is too difficult to resolve. So let us find guidance in the Quran alone. Some early scholars who were from the Quran-only movement in Northern, which started in Punjab, the Punjab province in the late 1800s, early 20th century, they actually said that, you know, we don't even need to pray five times a day because the Quran does not say pray five times a day. That position was a little bit controversial. didn't go too far. Other scholars tried to come up with arguments to actually mine the Quran, read it in very specific ways to try and identify how the Quran actually spells out the five daily prayers, which is, again, not very convincing. So the Quran-only movement has a real problem in its at its core, which is that if you say you are only going to use the Quran, then you have to abandon things like the five daily prayers. You have to abandon things like the details of the Ramadan fast. You have to abandon things like the specifics of how we do wudu. And once you do that, you've abandoned the religion of Islam. These are things that all Muslims always agreed upon. Always. It doesn't matter if you're Shiite or Sunni. It doesn't matter if you're Hanafi or Maliki. They always agree on this. So to leave these practices is to go outside the boundaries of Islam. So sometimes, I think this is a very important point to keep in mind, that it's impossible to read the Quran without the Sunnah. And it's very interesting, there is no sect of Islam, not in Sunni Islam, not in Shiite Islam, not even Ismaili Shiites, not even Ismailis say that the Quran should be read alone. All these groups, every sect of Muslims until the 20th century, every school of thought amongst Muslims believes you have to read the Quran through the Sunnah of the Prophet. Then they disagree about what the Sunnah of the Prophet is. If you're Hanbali, you believe it's maybe a little bit more hadiths. If you're Hanafi, maybe you rely more on analogy and qiyas. If you're Imami Shiite, you believe that the Sunnah is transmitted through the Imams, the 12 Imams. If you're Ismaili, you believe the Sunnah continues to be transmitted by the Imamate all the way up until today. But all these groups, they all agree the Quran is not read on its own. You cannot have the Quran only. It's always read through the Sunnah. And there's one translation, actually, of the Quran. I found it very interesting when I read it. It's by, actually, a Turkish scholar, but he lives in the United States. He lives in Arizona. His name is Edip Yüksel. And he has a translation of the Quran called the Reformist Quran. And he says that this is the first Quran-only translation of the Quran that doesn't rely on any hadiths, it doesn't rely on any tradition, where you just get the wisdom of the Quran alone through the Quran. And he says, the author or the translator says, that in order to understand the Quran, he only looks at the way that the Quran uses words in different locations. So if I don't know what the word means in this verse, I look at other verses where the word appears, and that way I understand it. And sometimes, I actually appreciate, but sometimes he's very honest. So, for example, the Quran says, we give you Kawthar. What is Kawthar? He says, I have no idea what Kawthar is. Because there's no way for him to tell. And I thought, wow, maybe I've come across the first really honest Quran-only book, where this person, he says, I'm only going to use the Quran, and really, I'm only going to use the Quran. But then I found something which revealed that inconsistency, that inevitable inconsistency that will always trip up or reveal the weakness of the Quran-only approach. In the concept of dhihar, وَالَّذِينَ يُظَاهِرُونَ مِنْكُمْ مِنْ نِسَائِهِمْ مَا هُنَّ أُمَّهَاتِهِمْ, right? Those in Surah Al-Mujadila, those amongst you who do dhihar, yudahiruna, of their women, they are not their mothers. Now, this doesn't make any sense if you're just using Arabic grammar. If you go and you look all this verb dhahara, yudahiru, if you look at all the other places in the Quran where this word is used, it means to grant assistance to somebody. But in the beginning of Surah Al-Mujadila, it talks about those people who do dhihar to their wives, they're not their mothers. And if those people who do the harm to their wives take their wives back, then they have to free a slave. What the heck does this mean? Imagine you've looked in all the other parts of the Quran, looked at this verb dhahira, and it only means to grant assistance to people. But, and I thought maybe this translator, this Quran only translator, will be honest. He'll say, I don't know what this means. But he didn't. He said, those people who say to their wives, you are like the back of my mother to me. These are not their mothers. And if you say this and then you take your wife back, you have to free a slave. So how did this translator understand the meaning of the verse? He looked in Arabic dictionaries and looked up dhahara, and he said one of the meanings is to say to your wife, you're like the back of my mother to me, which is a way of the pre-Islamic Arabs would divorce their wives. And the Quran basically disapproves of this act. So this translator could say, but I didn't look at hadiths, I didn't look at the Sunnah of the Prophet, I looked at a dictionary. The problem is, where do you think Arabic dictionaries came from? Arabic dictionaries today come from earlier Arabic dictionaries, and earlier Arabic dictionaries come from the earliest Arabic dictionaries, books like Kitab al-Ayn of al-Khalil ibn Ahmed in the early 800s, or the work of early Muslims who went around during the early decades, the first 150 years of Islam, collecting rare words from Bedouins, collecting poetry to understand the words of the Quran. And one of the things they found is this dhahar. And they also had hadiths in which the Prophet explained what dhahar meant. That it's when somebody says to their mother, to their wife, you're like the back of my mother to me, and therefore I'm repudiating you. Guess who transmitted the meaning of the word dhahar to the early Muslim dictionary collectors and scholars of language? The exact same people who transmitted hadiths to people like Bukhari and Malik. So the very language that we use to understand the Quran is transmitted by the same tradition that transmits the Sunnah of the Prophet to us. And if you think you can read the Quran without a dictionary, or you think you can understand words like dhahar without finding that last entry in the dictionary that explains an ancient meaning of the word that's not used anymore, but which tells you about a custom in the time of the Prophet, to think you can do that without tradition, you're fooling yourself. You're not just fooling yourself, but you're actually misleading those people who are claiming to call to a freed or reformed reading of the Quran. You cannot escape tradition. You cannot escape the need for the Sunnah of the Prophet in our understanding of the Quran. As I said earlier, and I'll end on this point, as I said earlier, Muslim scholars have always acknowledged the need for the Sunnah. But they've also understood that the Quran speaks to us in many ways, and that sometimes we'll disagree on how the Quran is speaking to us, what it's saying, what the laws are it's giving us, what the rules are it's telling us. Muslim scholars have always understood that there are debates about what the Sunnah of the Prophet is. That we might debate whether the Prophet raised his hands when he prayed, or whether he just went down and bowed without raising his hands. But these disagreements are minor in comparison with the great principles of the religion, with its foundations. And that's why Muslim scholars, going back to Imam Shafi'i, always said, the disagreement is in the details of our law, of our tradition. It's not in the principles. It's not on the main points. And that remains the truth until today. Alhamdulillah. جزاكم الله خير واستغفر لي لكم استغفروا